There is a hint in the decision that the captains thought Clark was the better at approaching and dealing with Indians, but just a hint. The makeup of Clark's party is puzzling. Why did Charbonneau have to ask to come along, and why didn't Clark bring Sacagawea? The captains had brought her all this way so that she could be the contact person with the Shoshones. Instead, Clark was proposing to approach them with three other armed men, none of them proficient with the sign language. Driar was camped upriver a few miles that night. He had been hunting. The only Shoshone words Clark knew he had been taught by Sacagawea. He had asked her what was her people's word for white man. Tababone, she replied. Actually, the Shoshones had no word for white man, never having seen one. Scholars have guessed that Tababone might have meant stranger or enemy. Certainly bringing along a recently ill young woman with a papoose on her back would have slowed the party. But then how fast was Clark going to go with his feet in tatters? Anyway, proceeding slowly would have been preferable to blundering ahead, hoping to bump into some Indians, yet having no way to communicate with them. When it came his turn to lead an overland search for Shoshones, Lewis followed Clark's example and did not ask Sacagawea to accompany him. The captain shared a hubris that they could handle Indians. They believed they needed Sacagawea's interpreting ability only to trade for horses, not to establish contact. And they had no ability whatsoever to see the initial encounter from the Shoshone's point of view. Four-man parties, armed better even than the Blackfeet, approaching on foot, shouting something that sounded like stranger or enemy. Did Clark really expect these Indians to come running to embrace him when they saw the American flag? In this case, it would seem that the captains allowed their self-confidence, and perhaps their male chauvinism, to override their common sense. Clark set out the next morning, July 23rd, in search of Indians. Lewis headed upriver. Conditions were awful. Our trio of pests still invade and obstruct us on all occasions. These are the mosquitoes, eye gnats, and prickly pears. It was hot. Progress was measured in yards, even feet. The men complain of being much fatigued. Their labor is excessively great. So moved was Lewis by their effort, and so eager was he to get on, that I occasionally encourage them by assisting in the labor of navigating the canoes, and have learned to push a tolerable good pole, in their phrase. He still had time for observation. Signs of beaver were noted, and otter. Cranes, geese, red-breasted mergansers, and curlews brought comment. He saw a great number of snakes, killed one, examined its teeth to see if they were hollow and thus would carry poison, and found them innocent. What excited wonder also caused worry. The mountains, they still continue high and seem to rise in some places like an amphitheater, one range above another, as they recede from the river until the most distant and lofty have their tops clad with snow. They loomed out there every time Lewis looked to his right, waiting for him. Another frustration. The river was now flowing from a southeasterly direction, so progress was taking the expedition in exactly the wrong direction. Another worry. Although Sacagawea insisted that there were no falls or obstructions in the river above, Lewis confessed, I can scarcely form an idea of a river running to great extent through such a rough mountainous country without having its stream intercepted by some difficult and dangerous rapids or falls. Another pest, needle grass, an invention of the devil, consisting of barbed seeds which penetrate our moccasins and leather leggings and give us great pain until they are removed. My poor dog suffers with them excessively. He is constantly biting and scratching himself as if in a rack of pain. Another day on the river, making about 18 miles per day. Endless. Exhausting. July 27th. We set out at an early hour and proceeded on, but slowly. The current still so rapid that the men are in a continual state of their utmost exertion to get on, and they begin to weaken fast from this continual state of violent exertion. They had reached the breaking point. Then fortune smiled. Just around the turn, at 9 o'clock a.m., Lewis in the lead canoe came to a junction with a river from the southeast. A quarter mile or so upstream, two rivers came together, a southwest fork, and a middle fork, making the Three Forks. As Lewis described it, "The country opened suddenly to extensive and beautiful plains and meadows, which appear to be surrounded in every direction with distant and lofty mountains." He came to shore on the larboard side. Telling the men to rest, he set out to climb a nearby high limestone cliff. At the top, "I commanded a most perfect view of the neighboring country." Looking up the southeast fork, he saw smooth, extensive green meadow of fine grass. A distant range of lofty mountains rose their snow-clad tops above the irregular and broken mountains which lie adjacent to this beautiful spot. From the cliff Lewis stood on, the view today is still spectacular. There are modern intrusions, Interstate Highway 90, Montana Highway 287, and a few secondary roads run through it, and the little town of Three Forks is a few miles away, but the overall scene is as it was. There is a tremendous bowl containing the linked valleys of the two rivers coming out of today's Yellowstone Park to the south and east, and the valley of the river to the southwest, coming down from the Madisons. The rivers are crowded with fish and waterfowl. The banks are crowded with deer. The mountains surround the bowl in a nearly complete circle of up to 100 miles in diameter and are just as Lewis saw them, lofty and snow-covered. After writing a description of the Three Forks area, Lewis returned to the canoes, ate breakfast, and led the flotilla upstream. At the junction of the Middle and the Southwest Forks, he found a note Clark had written and stuck on a pole. It said he would rejoin Lewis here unless he fell in with some fresh sign of Indians, in which case he intended to follow the Indians and would count on Lewis to ascend the southwest or right-hand fork. Lewis immediately agreed with Clark's judgment that the right-hand was the fork to take. He set up camp and made plans to stay a while because, "believing this to be an essential point in the geography of this western part of the continent, I determined to remain at all events until I obtained the necessary data for fixing its latitude, longitude, etc." And it wouldn't hurt to give the men a chance to rest. Lewis set out to explore. Comparing the Middle Fork with the Southwest Fork, he could see no difference in character or size. Therefore, to call either of these streams the Missouri would be giving it a preference which its size does not warrant, as it is not larger than the other. They are each 90 yards wide. Lewis named the Southeast Fork Gallatin's River, in honor of Albert Gallatin, Secretary of the Treasury. The Middle Fork he called Madison's River, in honor of James Madison, Secretary of State. The Southwest Fork, the one he intended to follow, he called Jefferson's River, in honor of that illustrious personage Thomas Jefferson, President of the United States. At 3 o'clock p.m., Captain Clark came into camp. He was extremely sick, completely exhausted. He told Lewis he had been sick all night, with a high fever, frequent chills, and constant pains in his muscles. Nevertheless, in the morning, he had made a forced march of about 8 miles up the Middle Fork, but finding no Indian sign, decided to return to Three Forks. He said he was somewhat bilious and had not had a passage for several days. Lewis convinced Clark that a dozen of Rush's pills would be sovereign in this case. He said it always worked. Clark agreed to take 5. Lewis also convinced Clark to bathe his feet in warm water. Despite the treatment, Clark closed his short journal entry for the day. "I continue to be very unwell, fever very high." Lewis closed his journal that night with a worry. "We begin to feel considerable anxiety with respect to the Snake Indians," he wrote. "If we do not find them, I fear the successful issue of our voyage will be very doubtful, or at all events much more difficult in its accomplishment." He believed the expedition would soon reach the bosom of this wild and mountainous country, and realized that meant game would grow scarce, perhaps even non-existent. Meanwhile, the expedition would be without any information with respect to the country, not knowing how far these mountains continue, or where to direct our course to pass them to advantage, or intercept a navigable branch of the Columbia. Without Shoshone horses, without Shoshone information, the expedition might as well turn around and go home, or so Lewis feared, although he was prepared to press on as long as it was possible. He consoled himself with the thought that the Jefferson River had to head with the tributaries of the Columbia. As to the lack of game, he figured that If any Indians can subsist in the form of a nation in these mountains with the means they have of acquiring food, we can also subsist. The expedition spent 2 days at the Three Forks, the men making clothing or hunting, Lewis making celestial observations, Clark recuperating. Always the booster and developer, Lewis proposed the establishment of a fort at Three Forks, at the far western limit of Louisiana, where the rivers and creeks teemed with beaver. That it was almost 3,000 miles up the Missouri from St. Louis and the nearest civilization bothered him not a bit. There was plenty of timber, and the grass is luxuriant and would afford a fine swath of hay. Sacajawea informed him that the expedition's camp was precisely on the spot where the Shoshones had been camped 5 years ago, when a raiding party of Hidatsas discovered them. The Shoshones had retreated 3 miles upriver and hidden in a wood. But the Hidatsas had found and routed them, killing 4 men, 4 women, and a number of boys, and making prisoners of 4 boys and all the remaining women, including Sacajawea. "I cannot discover that she shows any imitation of sorrow in recollecting this event," Lewis concluded his journal entry relating Sacajawea's story, "or of joy in being again restored to her native country. If she has enough to eat and a few trinkets to wear, I believe she would be perfectly content anywhere." One wonders if Lewis was comparing Sacajawea with the young black female slaves he had known, or with white women of his own class. One wonders, too, how the man who could be so observant about so many things, including the feelings and point of view of his men, could be so unobservant about Sacajawea's situation. A slave, one of only 2 in the party, she was also the only Indian, the only mother, the only woman, the only teenaged person. Small wonder she kept such a tight grip on her emotions. Captain Clark had improved somewhat. Though his fever was gone, he was still very languid and complains of a general soreness in all his limbs. Lewis prescribed Peruvian bark for the tonic effect of its quinine. Over the next week, Lewis, with Driar and small parties of men, and once Sacajawea, marched ahead of the canoes, searching for Indians. The early August sun beat down on the hikers. On the first day of the month, Lewis described himself as much exhausted by the heat of the day, the roughness of the road, and the want of water. He nevertheless discovered and described the blue grouse and the pinyon jay. He found a profusion of berries, now ripe and in full perfection. We feasted sumptuously on our wild fruit. He saw more beaver signs than he had ever thought possible. He named 2 tributaries of the Jefferson River. We called the bold, rapid, and clear stream Wisdom, and the more mild and placid one Philanthropy, in commemoration of 2 of those cardinal virtues which have so eminently marked that deservedly celebrated character, Jefferson, through life. The junction of the Wisdom and the Jefferson presented a familiar problem. Which river to follow? Lewis decided on the Jefferson, not because it was bigger, it carried less water than the Wisdom, but because it was much warmer, from which I concluded that it had its source at a greater distance in the mountains. He wrote a note to Clark, recommending that he bring the canoes up the Jefferson if he got to the junction before Lewis returned from a 2-day scout for Indians. He stuck the note on a pole at the fork of the river and set out with Driar, Charbonneau, and Sergeant Gass, who had disabled himself in an accident and was in great pain, too much so to work a canoe, though, according to Lewis, he could march with convenience. 2 days later, August 6th, Lewis returned to the area, empty-handed with regard to the Shoshones. Now he heard the whooping of the party to my left. He marched toward the sound and found Clark and the canoes on the Wisdom River. They were a sorry mess. 1 canoe had just overset and all its baggage was wet, including the medicine box. 2 other canoes had filled with water. Immediate action was necessary. The first object, Lewis wrote, was to examine, dry, and arrange the stores. They made a camp on a gravel bar at the mouth of the Wisdom and spread the stuff out to dry. That job done, the captains talked. Why was Clark going up the Wisdom? Hadn't he seen Lewis's note? He had not. The captains puzzled over this, then concluded that Lewis had put the note on a green pole. A passing beaver had cut it down and carried it off, together with the note. The possibility of such an occurrence never once occurred to me when I placed it on the green pole, Lewis confessed. Clark had not agreed with Lewis on which river to take. He had gone up the Wisdom because he thought it went more directly in the direction the expedition wanted to go, but the Wisdom was much too narrow, willow-infested, rapid, and twisty. Clark said that he had met with Driard before Lewis came up, that Driard had informed him of the true state of the two rivers, and that he was in the process of turning around, which was what caused the canoe to upset, when Lewis arrived. Another worry. Clark had sent Private Shannon ahead, up the Wisdom, to hunt. When Clark met Driard and decided to turn around, he told Driard to proceed upstream, catch up with Shannon, and bring him back. But toward dusk, Driard came in to report he could not find Shannon. Lewis ordered the trumpet sounded and had the men fire a couple of volleys, but Shannon made no appearance. In the morning, August 7th, the captains decided they had so far exhausted their supplies that they could proceed with one canoe less, so they hid and secured one in a thicket of brush. In the afternoon, they made 7 miles up the Jefferson. Shannon failed to join the party. On the 8th, they made 14 river miles, but as Lewis noted, although we travel briskly and a considerable distance, yet it takes us only a few miles on our general course or route, because the river was very crooked, many short bends. 3 days previously, Lewis had noted that the men were so much fatigued today that they wished much that navigation was at an end, that they might go by land. Morale and the energy level were sinking fast. The Corps of Discovery was becoming a walking hospital. Captain Clark's intestinal problems had disappeared, but he had developed a tumor on his ankle, which was much swollen and inflamed, and gave him considerable pain. Sergeant Gass, Charbonneau, and 4 or 5 of the enlisted men had various indispositions. Everyone was more or less exhausted most of the time. But that afternoon, Sacagawea again gave the men a much-needed lift. As Lewis put it, "The Indian woman recognized the point of a high plain to our right, which she informed us was not very distant from the summer retreat of her nation on a river beyond the mountains which runs to the west. She said the Shoshones called the hill the Beaver's Head, from a supposed resemblance of its shape to the head of a swimming beaver. She assures us that we shall either find her people on this river or on the river immediately west of its source." So close. The man wanted to hide the canoes, put the baggage on their backs, and march to the dividing ridge. But if the captains let them do that, they would have to leave the greater part of the baggage as well as the canoes, and in Lewis's view, "We have a stock already sufficiently small for the length of the voyage before us." They had to have horses. "As it is now all important with us to meet with those people, the Shoshones, as soon as possible," Lewis wrote, "the captains decided to send out an overland party that would stay out until it located the Indians. Clark wanted to lead it, but the raging fury of a tumor on my ankle muscle made it impossible for him to walk." Lewis's determination was absolute. His intention was to proceed tomorrow with a small party to the source of the principal stream of this river and pass the mountains to the Columbia, and down that river until I found the Indians. In short, it is my resolution to find them, or some others who have horses, if it should cause me a trip of 1 month. In the morning, before breakfast, Lewis did some writings, which I conceived from the nature of my instructions necessary, lest any accident should befall me on the long and rather hazardous route I was now about to take. What those writings consisted of, no one knows. It sounds as if they were written instructions to Clark in the event he did not return. Did he tell Clark to press on, whatever happened to him, or to fall back to St. Louis and try again the next year with a bigger party? This was the first time he had done such a thing. Clearly, he felt he had arrived at the critical moment and that he was in a do-or-die situation. He was a man whose mind never stopped working, and during his long walks on the plains or in the mountains, he had plenty of time to think, even though his eyes were constantly picking up flora and fauna, geographical features, the distance to this or that spot, and registering them in his mind so he could write about them in his journal. That was the naturalist explorer in him, and his interest never flagged. But he was also an army officer operating under orders to go to the Pacific and return and report. and he was a company commander responsible for the lives of 30 men. So what was the military officer explorer thinking? In that capacity, Lewis was a worrier who took care to put his concerns down on paper. The question, "Where is Shannon?" led to conjecture. Lewis's thought was that he must have shot an elk or two and was waiting beside the Wisdom for the expedition to come to him. Which river to take? Can we possibly make it without horses? Always he worried about the state of the men's health and wondered how much more of this they could take. As to what he thought lay ahead, on August 10th he wrote, "I do not believe that the world can furnish an example of a river running to the extent which the Missouri and Jefferson rivers do through such a mountainous country and at the same time so navigable as they are." His men were already questioning that word navigable, but his optimism remained. "If the Columbia furnishes us such another example, a communication across the continent by water will be practicable and safe." This had to be the triumph of faith in Jefferson at the expense of what he was seeing with his own eyes, the men at their uttermost limits and still so far to go. His realism returned to him. "This, a short portage and an easy float to the Pacific, I can scarcely hope from a knowledge of its having in its comparatively short course to the ocean the same number of feet to descend which the Missouri and Mississippi have from this point to the Gulf of Mexico." His mind covered the continent. If the Columbia had only one-fifth the course to run to get to sea level as the Missouri-Mississippi, and if they started out within a short hike of each other, then the Columbia was going to have lots more falls and rapids than anything they had so far encountered. But his fixed rule was always to assume the road ahead was good, until proved otherwise. Only a tiny number of people have ever had the experience of not knowing what they would see when they got to the top of the mountain, or turned into the river, or sailed around the tip of a continent. Lewis expected that when he got up the mountain to the divide, he would see something resembling the country he was traveling through. Long, sweeping valleys dropping down to the broader valley of the Jefferson, only in this case the stream would be running to the south branch of the Columbia. Whatever he saw, he was either going to find horses on this trip and get over the mountains and onto the Columbia, or die in the attempt. Aside from his own calculation about the nature of the Columbia, he seldom wrote about what he expected to see. He did write about what the Hidatsas told him. Their information was awfully sketchy beyond Three Forks and non-existent on the western side of the divide. Lewis's theoretical expectation, learned from Jefferson, was that the Rockies were a single chain of mountains like the Appalachians. But given that the Rockies were so much higher than anything east of the Mississippi, he really didn't know what he would see. With regard to the Indians he was seeking, he neglected to think through his situation. He just blundered ahead on the unshakable and unacknowledged assumption that he was such an expert in handling Indians that when he met a Shoshone, he would know instinctively what to do. If he ever interviewed Sacajawea about her people, he didn't consider it important enough to put into his journal. If he ever asked her what the country beyond the divide was like, he didn't write about it. Clark's asking her how to say white man in Shoshone was the full extent of the captain's interrogation of the most valuable intelligence source they had available to them. That Lewis did not bring her along on the most important mission of his life is inexplicable. She had made long marches before and could again. Also inexplicable was the failure of the captains to talk with each other, and to bring Driard and Charbonneau in on the discussion, about what to do when contact was made with a Shoshone. Furthermore, Lewis held no conference with Driard and Privates John Shields and Hugh McNeil, the men he had selected to go on the mission with him, to tell them what to do when an Indian was spotted, how to behave, what signs to use, what to say. Lewis had good reason to believe the Shoshones would welcome the expedition. The tribe desperately needed contact with white traders so that the braves could arm themselves and fight the Blackfeet, Hidatsas, and other enemies on more equal terms. Of course, Lewis wasn't bringing the hard-pressed Shoshones any guns, only the promise that if the Shoshones cooperated, American traders would come to their country. Short-term, Lewis needed the Shoshones far more than they needed him. Long-term, their fate was tied up with the success of the expedition. But how to get them to recognize this would be a problem. So would getting past the initial moment of contact without anybody's firing or running away. These problems required a plan and a strategy, but the captains never developed either one. At breakfast on the morning of July 9th, a good omen for Lewis's mission, Shannon came in with 3 deer skins and an adventure story that had a happy ending. "Immediately after breakfast," Lewis wrote that night, "I slung my pack and set out." The first day he covered 16 miles. The second day it was 30 miles, ending up in one of the handsomest coves I ever saw, of about 16 or 18 miles in diameter. He had followed an old Indian road, but it gave out on him. On the morning of the 11th, he met with his party and gave out the closest thing to a plan he could come up with. They would spread out across the valley, headed west, looking for the Indian road. Driar would go out to the right, Shields to the left. McNeil would stay with Lewis. If Driar or Shields should find the road, he would notify Lewis by placing a hat on the muzzle of his rifle and holding it aloft. They marched abreast for 5 miles. No sign of a road. Suddenly, Lewis squinted, looked again, took out his telescope, and saw for sure an Indian on horseback about 2 miles distant coming down the plain toward us. His dress was Shoshone. His arms were a bow and quiver of arrows, and was mounted on an elegant horse without a saddle. "I was overjoyed at the sight of this stranger," Lewis wrote, "and had no doubt of obtaining a friendly introduction to his nation, provided I could get near enough to him to convince him of our being white men." Lewis hiked on at his usual pace. The Indian horsemen came on. But when they were about a mile apart, the Indian stopped. So did Lewis. Lewis pulled his blanket from his pack, threw it into the air, and spread it on the ground, which he understood to be a signal of friendship. Unfortunately, this signal had not the desired effect. He still kept his position. He was glancing from side to side. It seemed to Lewis that he was viewing Driar and Shields with an air of suspicion. Of course he was. The Indian was probably a teenager out on a scout, curious about these strangers, but cautious, brought up to fear all strangers. Coming at him were 4 armed men. How could he not be suspicious? Especially since the Shoshones had just suffered a serious loss of people and horses from a Blackfoot raid. Lewis wanted to make Driar and Shields halt, but they were out of shouting range, and I feared to make any signal to them lest it should increase the suspicion in the mind of the Indian of our having some unfriendly design upon him. Lewis spread out the pitiful supply of trade goods he had brought with him, some beads, a looking glass, a few trinkets. Leaving his rifle and pouch with McNeil, he advanced toward the Indian. The Indian sat on his horse and watched until Lewis was within 200 yards. At that point, he turned his horse and began to move off slowly. Desperate, Lewis called in as loud a voice as he could command, "Tababone!" repeatedly. Instead of responding to Lewis, the Indian kept watching Driar and Shields as they advanced. Lewis was furious with them. Neither of them having sagacity enough to recollect the impropriety of advancing when they saw me thus in parley with the Indian. Finally, he broke his rule not to make signals. He signaled them to stop. Driar saw and obeyed. Shields, who afterwards told me that he did not observe the signal, kept coming on. At 150 yards, Lewis repeated, "Tababone!" and held up the trinkets in my hands and stripped up my shirt sleeve to give him an opportunity of seeing the color of my skin. At 100 yards, the Indian suddenly turned his horse about, gave him the whip, leaped the creek, and disappeared in the willow brush in an instant, and with him vanished all hopes of obtaining horses for the present. I now felt quite as much mortification and disappointment as I had pleasure and expectation at the first sight of this Indian. He was sorely chagrined by the conduct of the men, particularly Shields, whom he blamed for the failure. "I now called the men to me," Lewis wrote, "and could not forbear upbraiding them a little for their want of attention and imprudence on this occasion." Blaming them wasn't going to accomplish anything, however, and Lewis's refusal to assess his own mistakes in the encounter is noticeable. Surely he was just as guilty as they were, if not more so. But he directed his anger at them. He had left his telescope with the blanket he had spread. McNeil had neglected to bring it along with the blanket, and Lewis seemed to take a bit of pleasure in ordering Driard and Shields to go back to search for it. When they found it and returned, the party set off on the track of the horse, McNeil carrying a small U.S. flag attached to a pole. Thinking that the Indians might well be watching from the surrounding hills, and not wanting to give them the idea that an advance on them was being made, Lewis halted at an open place, built a fire, and cooked and ate breakfast. But just as he started out again, a heavy shower of rain raised the grass and wiped out the track. He saw several places where it appeared to him that the Indians had been digging roots that day, which meant the main village couldn't be far off. At 20 miles, he made camp. On the morning of August 12th, we fell in with a large and plain Indian road. It passed a stout stream. Here we halted and breakfasted on the last of our venison, having yet a small piece of pork in reserve. They hiked on, headed toward a pass, the stream growing small as they ascended the gentle slope. At a distance of 4 miles further, the road took us to the most distant fountain of the waters of the mighty Missouri, in search of which we have spent so many toilsome days and restless nights. He assessed the impact on himself. Thus far, I had accomplished one of those great objects on which my mind has been unalterably fixed for many years. Judge then of the pleasure I felt in allaying my thirst with this pure and ice-cold water. Lewis was not alone in his rejoicing. 2 miles below, McNeil had exultingly stood with a foot on each side of this little rivulet and thanked his God that he had lived to bestride the mighty and heretofore deemed endless Missouri. Now was the moment to go to the top of the pass, to become the first American to look on Idaho and the great Northwestern Empire. Lewis described the moment. We proceeded on to the top of the dividing ridge from which I discovered immense ranges of high mountains still to the west of us, with their tops partially covered with snow. To what degree Lewis was surprised or disheartened by the sight, he never said. John Logan Allen asks us to imagine the shock and the surprise, for from the top of that ridge were to be seen neither the great river that had been promised, nor the open plains extending to the shores of the South Sea. What Allen calls the geography of hope had to give way to the geography of reality. With Lewis's last step to the top of the divide went decades of theory about the nature of the Rocky Mountains, shattered by a single glance from a single man. Equally shattered were Lewis's hopes for an easy portage to a major branch of the Columbia. But whatever Lewis felt as he first saw the Bitterroot Range of the Rocky Mountains, he never wrote about. Nor did he write about his feelings as he took his first step on the western side of the divide, outside of Louisiana. He descended the mountain, which was much steeper than the approach on the eastern side, about 3/4 of a mile, to a handsome, bold running creek of cold, clear water. Here I first tasted the water of the great Columbia River. The party proceeded another 10 miles or so before making camp. As we had killed nothing during the day, we now boiled and ate the remainder of our pork, having yet a little flour and parched meal. Lewis was deep into Indian country with only 3 men, and his main body 3 or 4 days' march away. He had a few gewgaws as his currency. He had a frightened Indian reporting back to the Shoshones that strangers were in the area. He had just been through enough experiences for an entire expedition, all in 1 day. He needed a good night's sleep, and lots of good luck in the morning. Chapter 22. Over the Continental Divide. August 13th to August 31st, 1805. On Tuesday morning, August 13th, 1805, Lewis set out early, headed west on a plain, heavily and recently used Indian trail that fell down a long descending valley. Along the way, he saw and described the Rocky Mountain maple, the skunkbush sumac, and the common snowberry. He stopped to collect seeds of the snowberry for Mr. Jefferson. At 9 miles, Lewis saw 2 Indian women, a man, and some dogs. When he had arrived within 1/2 mile of them, he ordered Driard and the 2 privates to halt, unslung his pack and rifle and put them on the ground, unfurled a flag, and advanced alone at a steady pace toward the Indians. The women retreated, but the man stayed in place until Lewis was within 100 yards. Lewis called out, "Tababone," loudly and frequently. The man absconded. Lewis had his men join him and proceeded. The country was cut by some short and steep ravines. After less than a mile, topping a rise, they came on three Indian women, one a 12-year-old, one a teen, and the third elderly, only 30 yards away. At the first sight, Lewis laid down his rifle and advanced on the group. The teen ran off, but the old woman and the child remained. Seeing no chance to escape, they sat on the ground and held their heads down. To Lewis, it looked as though they had reconciled themselves to die. He approached and took the elderly woman by the hand, raised her up, said, "Taba bone," and rolled up his shirt sleeve to show her his white skin. His hands and face were so deeply tanned he might have been an Indian, and his clothes were entirely leather. Driar and the privates joined him. From their packs he gave the woman some beads, a few moccasin awls, a few mirrors, and some paint. His skin and the gifts, and his friendly attitude, were enough to calm her down. Through Driar's sign language, he asked her to call the teen back, fearing that otherwise the girl might alarm the main body of Shoshones. The old woman did as he asked, and the teen reappeared. Lewis gave her some trinkets and painted the tawny cheeks of the women with some vermilion. When the Indians were composed, Lewis told them, through Driar, that he wished them to conduct us to their camp, that we were anxious to become acquainted with the chiefs and warriors of their nation. They did as requested, and the group set off, the Indians leading. After 2 miles, the long-anticipated and eagerly sought contact took place. 60 warriors, mounted on excellent horses and armed for war with bows and arrows plus 3 inferior rifles, came on at full speed. When they saw Lewis's party, they halted. This was the first time an American had ever seen a Shoshone war party, and the first time this band of Shoshones had ever seen an American. The Indians were overwhelmingly superior. It would have been the work of only a moment for them to overwhelm Lewis's party, and they would have more than doubled their firepower and rifles, and gathered as loot more knives, awls, looking glasses, and other trinkets than any Rocky Mountain Indian band had ever seen. But rather than assuming a defensive position, Lewis laid down his rifle, picked up his flag, told his party to stay in place, and following the old woman who was guiding, advanced slowly toward he knew not what. A man Lewis assumed was the chief rode in the lead. He halted to speak to the old woman. She told him that these were white men, and exultingly showed the presents which had been given. This broke the tension. The chief and then the warriors dismounted. The chief advanced, saying, "Ahai, ahai," which Lewis later learned meant, "I am much pleased, I am much rejoiced." The chief put his left arm over Lewis's right shoulder and applied his left cheek to Lewis's right cheek, continuing to frequently vociferate the word "Ahai." The warriors and Lewis's men then came on, and we were all caressed and besmeared with their grease and paint till I was heartily tired of the national hug. This first meeting between Shoshones and Americans went better than Lewis could have dared to hope. He had been exceedingly lucky. The war party had ridden out in response to the alarm given by the man who had fled earlier that day. The Shoshones expected to find Blackfeet and might have attacked without pause, save for the old woman. Had Lewis not met her, and had she not responded so positively to his appeals and gifts, there might well have been a firefight. Instead, there was a parley. Lewis brought out his pipe and sat, indicating to the Indians that they should do the same. They did, but not without removing their moccasins, a custom among the Shoshones to indicate sincerity in friendship, or, as Lewis put it, which is as much to say that they wish they may always go barefoot if they are not sincere, a pretty heavy penalty if they are to march through the plains of their country. Lewis lit and passed the pipe. After smoking several rounds, he distributed some presents. The Shoshones were much pleased, particularly with the blue beads and vermilion. Lewis learned that the chief's name was Kamiawait. Lewis told him that the object of our visit was a friendly one, that after they reached Kamiawait's camp he would explain the expedition more fully, including who we were, from whence we had come, and whether we were going. He gave Kamiawait an American flag, which I informed him was an emblem of peace among white men, to be respected as the bond of union between us. Kamiawait spoke to his warriors, and soon the entire party set out for the main camp. He sent some youngsters ahead to inform the others to prepare for their arrival. When they reached the camp, on the east bank of the Limhi River, about 7 miles north of today's Tendoy, Idaho, Lewis was ushered into an old leather teepee, the only one the band had left after the Blackfoot raid, and ceremoniously seated on green boughs and antelope skins. After the ritual smoking, "I now explain to them the objects of our journey, etc." How well the Shoshones could comprehend a trip across the continent, or if they could even conceive of the continent, Lewis did not say. He was confident the sign language Driar was using was understood, even though he realized it was imperfect and liable to error. Still, the strong parts of the ideas are seldom mistaken. Women and children crowded around, eager to see these children of the Great Spirit. Lewis distributed the presents he had left to the delight of the Shoshones. One Shoshone warrior later described the mirrors as things like solid water, which were sometimes brilliant as the sun and which sometimes showed us our faces. By this time it was growing dark. Lewis and his men had not eaten in 24 hours. He mentioned this to Kamiyawait, who said he was sorry, but the band had nothing but berries to eat. He gave the white men some cakes of service berries and choke cherries. "Of these I made a hearty meal," Lewis wrote. He strolled down to the Limhi River and found it a rapid, clear stream about 40 yards wide and 3 feet deep. Through Driar's signs, Lewis inquired about the course of the stream. Kamiyawait replied that a half-day's march north it joined with another, twice as large, coming in from the southwest, forming today's Salmon River. On further questioning, Kamiyawait said there was little timber along the river below, that the river was confined between inaccessible mountains, was very rapid and rocky insomuch that it was impossible for us to pass either by land or water down this river to the Great Lake, where the white men lived, as he had been informed. Kamiyawait was referring to the traders who called at the mouth of the Columbia River. His description of the salmon was as accurate as it was unwelcome. It confirmed what Lewis must have feared when he first gazed on the Bitterroots from Limhi Pass. There was no all-water route, or anything remotely resembling it, across the continent. But Lewis dared to hope that this was untrue, suspecting that Kamiyawait was only trying to detain the Americans for trading purposes. In fact, as Lewis should have known from Sacagawea, it was time for Kamiyawait's band to cross the divide to meet other bands of Shoshones and Flatheads to go on a hunt in the Missouri River buffalo country. Having lied to the chief about the meaning of the flag and being prepared to tell more lies if necessary to meet his aims, Lewis was ready to believe the worst about Kamiyawait. The distressing information about the salmon was somewhat balanced for Lewis by the sight of a great number of horses feeding in every direction around their camp. Driar later counted 400 of them. Assuming he could trade for an adequate number of horses, Lewis had little doubt but we shall be enabled to transport our stores, even if we are compelled to travel by land over these mountains. His spirits were further raised when, on his return to his teepee, a warrior gave him a piece of fresh roasted salmon, "which I eat with a very good relish. This was the first salmon I had seen, and perfectly convinced me that we were on the waters of the Pacific Ocean." In other words, his positive assertion the previous day that he had first tasted the waters of the Columbia after crossing Limhi Pass had been more an expression of hope than a certain fact. For all he knew, the Limhi Salmon River might have been a tributary of the Dearborn River. That night, the Shoshones entertained Lewis and party with a dance. It lasted almost to dawn. At midnight, "I grew sleepy and retired to rest, leaving the men to amuse themselves with the Indians. I was several times awoke in the course of the night by their yells, but was too much fatigued to be deprived of a tolerable sound night's repose." With contact made, Lewis now had to give Clark time to come up the Jefferson as far as the fork that marked the extreme limit of navigation, if that limit had not already been passed. Clark was making only 4 or 5 miles a day in the shallow, boulder-covered bed of the Jefferson, which was not much more than a large creek. Lewis decided to spend the morning of August 14th writing in his journal, the afternoon in procuring further information from Kamiyawait about the country to the west. He sent Driar and the privates out to hunt. The Indians furnished them with horses, and some 20 young braves joined them. Lewis was treated to a sight few white men ever saw, a chase on horseback by the young Indian hunters after 10 pronghorns. It lasted about 2 hours and considerable part of the chase in view from my tent. The hunters returned. They had not killed a single antelope, and their horses foaming with sweat. When Driard returned, equally unsuccessful, Lewis used his sign language ability to ask Kamiawait to instruct me with respect to the geography of his country. The chief repeated what he had said the previous day with more details. After drawing a waving line on the ground to represent the river, he plied sand on each side of it to represent the vast mountains of rock eternally covered with snow through which the river passed. He spoke of perpendicular and even jutting rocks so closely hemmed in the river that there was no possibility of passing along the shore. The whole surface of the river was beat into perfect foam as far as the eye could reach, that the mountains were also inaccessible to man or horse. How, then, to cross those mountains? Kamiawait said he had never done it, but there was an old man in his band who could probably give me some information of the country to the northwest. He added that he had understood from the pierced-nosed Indians who inhabit this river below the Rocky Mountains that it ran a great way toward the setting sun and finally lost itself in a great lake of water which was illy tasted. That sentence linked the continent. For the first time, a white man had a map, however imperfect and imprecise, to connect the great rivers of the Western Empire. Also, for the first time, a white man heard of the Nez Perces, the major tribe living west of the mountains. Kamiawait added that the Nez Perces crossed to the Missouri River buffalo country to hunt each year. "What route did they use?" Lewis asked. "It was to the north," the chief answered, but added that the road was a very bad one, as he had been informed by them, and that they had suffered excessively with hunger on the route, being obliged to subsist for many days on berries alone, as there was no game in that part of the mountains which were broken, rocky, and so thickly covered with timber that they could scarcely pass. Far from being downcast by such a description, Lewis was encouraged. "My route was instantly settled in my own mind," he wrote. "I felt perfectly satisfied that if the Indians could pass these mountains with their women and children, that we could also pass them." This is a wonderful sentence. It shows his complete confidence in himself, Captain Clark, and the men. He is not boasting or challenging, just being matter-of-fact about it. If they can, we can. It also shows Lewis's and Clark's ability to get more out of the men than the men ever thought they could give. Ascending the Missouri in the keelboat, the bitter cold winter at Mandan, the awful labor at the Great Falls Portage, the incredible labor getting the canoes up the Jefferson, every time they had such an experience behind them, the men agreed that it had to be the worst, and that they could not possibly endure anything worse. Only to have it get worse. But well-led men working together can do far more than they ever thought they could, especially if they are in life-threatening situations, which was exactly where Lewis intended to lead them. He dared to do so because he knew they had more in them than they thought, and he knew how to bring out the best in them. Kamiawait had more information. He said there were no buffalo west of the mountains, that the Indians who lived there subsisted on salmon and roots. He complained about the Spanish policy of never selling guns to Indians, whereas the English sold guns to the Blackfeet, Hidatsas, and other enemies of the Shoshones. With that advantage in firepower, the Plains Indians were continually harassing the Shoshones, who were forced to hide in the interior of the mountains most of the year. But, Kamiawait added, "with his fierce eyes and lank jaws grown meager for the want of food, such would not be the case if we had guns. We could then live in the country of buffalo and eat as our enemies do." Here was the opening Lewis sought. Here was the opportunity to make promises that would induce Kamiawait to help with the portage over the Continental Divide and to trade for horses that could get the expedition over the Bitterroots on the Nez Perce route. Lewis said that he had already induced the Hidatsas to promise that they would no longer raid against the Shoshones or make war on any of their neighbors, even though he knew that the Hidatsas had sent out a war party that spring, and that when the expedition got to the Pacific and then returned to the United States, White men would come to them, the Shoshones, with an abundance of guns and every other article necessary to their defense and comfort. Since the expedition was now more than 3,000 river miles from St. Louis, that was a promise for an uncertain future. He made it anyway. Lewis told Kamiyawe that he wanted the band to cross Limhi Pass with him in the morning, bringing 30 horses, to meet with Clark and the main party at the forks of Jefferson River and help bring the baggage over the pass and down to the Indian camp on the Limhi River, where we would then remain some time among them and trade with them for horses. Kamiyawe agreed. He made a lengthy harangue to his village, then told Lewis that everything was settled. They would start in the morning. Lewis was overjoyed. The Shoshone horses, he wrote, were excellent. Indeed, many of them would make a figure on the south side of James River or the land of fine horses. Even better, they had some sure-footed mules. Lewis went to his teepee to sleep in a happy mood. As for the Indians, they were very merry. They danced again this evening until midnight. Lewis woke on the morning of Thursday, August 15th, as hungry as a wolf. The previous day he had nothing to eat save a scant meal of flour and berries, which had not satisfied him as it appeared to do my Indian friends. He had 2 pounds of flour left. He told McNeil to divide the flour into 2 equal parts and to cook 1 half mixed with berries. On this new-fashioned pudding, 4 of us breakfasted, giving a pretty good allowance also to the chief, who declared it the best thing he had tasted for a long time. After breakfast, a crisis. The warriors would not move, despite Kamiyawe's urging. Lewis asked after the cause and was told that some foolish persons among them had suggested the idea that we were in league with the Pockies, the Shoshone word for Atsinas, and had come on in order to decoy them into an ambuscade where their enemies were waiting to receive them. Lewis told Kamiyawe that he forgave the warriors their suspicion. I knew they were not acquainted with white men, that among white men it was considered disgraceful to lie or entrap an enemy by falsehood. After that stretcher, Lewis threatened that if the Shoshones did not help with the portage, no white man would come to bring them arms and ammunition. Then he challenged their manhood, saying, I still hope that there were some among them that were not afraid to die. The challenge touched on the right string. To doubt the bravery of a savage is at once to put him on his mettle. Kamiyawe mounted his horse and gave a speech to his people, saying he would go with the white men to convince himself of the truth of what Lewis said. He added that he hoped some at least of the warriors would join him. 6 mounted their horses. The small party set out, even though several of the old women were crying and imploring the Great Spirit to protect their warriors as if they were going to inevitable destruction. The Indians rode on anyway, and soon enough another 6 men and 3 women joined them, making altogether a party of 16 Indians and 4 white men. Lewis was struck by the capricious disposition of those people who never act but from the impulse of the moment. They were now very cheerful and gay, and 2 hours ago they looked as surly as so many imps of Saturn. They crossed Limhi Pass and descended to Shoshone Cove, where they camped on the creek and had their 2nd meal of the day. I now cooked and among 6 of us eat the remaining pound of flour, stirred in a little boiling water. The Shoshones, save Kamiyawe and an unnamed warrior, had nothing to eat that day. The next morning, August 16th, Lewis sent Driar and Shields out to kill some meat. He asked Kamiyawe to keep his young men in camp so that they would not alarm the game. That was a mistake, for it reawakened the suspicions of the Shoshones. They feared the white men were trying to make contact with the Blackfeet, so 2 parties of warriors set out on each side of the valley to spy on Driar and Shields. Lewis, McNeil, and the remainder of the Shoshones followed. After about an hour, when we saw one of the spies coming up the level plain under whip, the chief paused a little and seemed somewhat concerned. I felt a good deal so myself. Lewis's fear was that by some unfortunate accident, the Blackfeet really were in the neighborhood. But when the scout arrived, breathless, he had good news. Driar had killed a deer. In an instant, they all gave their horses the whip. Lewis was riding double with a young warrior. The Indian was whipping the horse at every jump for a mile, fearing he should lose a part of the feast. As I was without stirrups, the jostling was disagreeable. Lewis reined in his horse and forbade the young man to use the lash. The Indian jumped off and ran on foot at full speed for a whole mile. At the side of the kill, the scene when I arrived was such that, had I not have had a pretty keen appetite myself, I am confident I should not have tasted any part of the venison. Each Indian had a piece of some description and all eating most ravenously. Some were eating the kidneys, the melt, the spleen, and liver and the blood running from the corners of their mouths. Others were in a similar situation with the paunch and guts. One of the last to arrive had provided himself with about 9 feet of the small guts, one end of which he was chewing on, while with his hands he was squeezing the contents out at the other. I really did not until now think that human nature ever presented itself in a shape so nearly allied to the brute creation. I viewed these poor starved devils with pity and compassion. However heartfelt, his pity and compassion did not extend far enough for him to note that if the Indians appeared savage with the blood running down their cheeks, they had taken only the parts of the deer Driar had thrown away when he dressed the kill. They had not touched the meat. Lewis saved a hind quarter for himself and his men and gave the balance to Kamiyawe to divide among his people. They devoured it without bothering to start a fire to cook it. The party then moved on. Soon word came that Driar had killed a second deer. Here nearly the same scene was encored. Lewis started a fire to cook his meat. Driar came in with a third deer, of which Lewis saved a quarter and gave the rest to the Indians, who were finally full and thus in a good humor. Shields then killed a pronghorn. The problem of food was solved for that day. As the party approached the forks, where Lewis had told the Indians they would meet Clark, Kamiyawait insisted on halting. With much ceremony, he put tippets, such as the Shoshones were wearing, around the necks of the white men. Lewis realized that the chief's suspicions were still strong, that he wanted to make the white men look like Indians in case it was Blackfeet and not Clark waiting at the forks. Realizing this, Lewis took off his cocked hat and put it on Kamiyawait. The men followed his example, and we were soon completely metamorphosed. The entire party moved downstream to the forks. Lewis had a warrior carry the flag so that our own party should know who we were. But when they got to within a couple of miles of the forks, I discovered to my mortification that Clark had not arrived. "I now scarcely knew what to do," Lewis confessed, "and feared every moment when they would halt altogether." Desperate, he gave Kamiyawait his rifle and told him that if the Blackfeet were around, he could use it to defend himself. That for my own part, I was not afraid to die, and if I deceived him, he might make what use of the gun he thought proper, or, in other words, that he might shoot me. Lewis had his men give up their rifles, too, which seemed to inspire them, the Indians, with more confidence. This bold move bought Lewis enough time to think of a plan. Recalling that he had left a note for Clark at the forks, I now had resource to a stratagem in which I thought myself justified by the occasion, but which, I must confess, set a little awkward. He sent Driar, accompanied by a warrior, to pick up the note. When Driar returned with the note, and the warrior's confirmation that he had picked it up at the forks, Lewis told Kamiyawe that Clark had written it, and that it said he, Clark, was just below, coming on, and that Lewis should wait for him at the forks. Lewis had told a lie that the Indians would never discover, but he was by no means through the crisis. Though his confidence in Clark was very great, in truth he did not know where Clark was. Clark might very well have found navigation impossible and be in camp many miles below, waiting for Lewis. Lewis came up with another stratagem. He told Kamiyawe that in the morning he would send Driar ahead to meet Clark and propose that a warrior accompany Driar to see the truth of his words. Lewis, Shields, and McNeil would remain with the main party of the Shoshones. This plan was readily adopted, and one of the young men offered his services. I promised him a knife and some beads as a reward for his confidence in us. He was taking a huge gamble. Several of the warriors were already complaining of Kamiyawait's exposing them to danger unnecessarily, and said that we told different stories. The Indians held their rifles. If Clark was not coming up the Jefferson, they could easily kill the white men, and almost certainly would, although the only fear Lewis expressed was that the Indians would immediately disperse and secret themselves in the mountains. He could hardly bear to think about it. At the least, we should be disappointed in obtaining horses, which would vastly retard and increase the labor of our voyage, and I feared might so discourage the men as to defeat the expedition altogether. To hold the Shoshones, Lewis told them that Sacagawea was with Clark, and that there was also a man with Clark, who was black and had short, curling hair. The Indians expressed great eagerness to see such a curiosity. Nevertheless, that night Lewis wrote in his journal, "My mind was in reality quite as gloomy as the most affrighted Indian, but I affected cheerfulness." He lay down to sleep, Kamayawate beside him. "I slept but little, as might be well expected, my mind dwelling on the state of the expedition, which I have ever held in equal estimation with my own existence, and the fate of which appeared at this moment to depend in a great measure upon the caprice of a few savages who are ever as fickle as the wind." In the morning, Lewis sent Driard and the warrior off at first light. The leftover meat from the previous day provided a scant breakfast. At about 9 o'clock a.m., an Indian who had gone down the creek for a mile or so returned and reported that the white men were coming. The Shoshones all appeared transported with joy. Lewis confessed, "I felt quite as much gratified at this information as the Indians appeared to be." Shortly thereafter, Clark arrived, accompanied by Charbonneau and Sacagawea. Kamayawate gave Clark the national hug and festooned his hair with shells. In the midst of the excitement, one of the Shoshone women recognized Sacagawea. Her name, Jumping Fish, she had acquired on the day Sacagawea was taken prisoner, because of the way she had jumped through a stream in escaping the Hidatsas. The reunited teens hugged and cried and talked,